Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we look at the people, the stories, and the events of Central Iowa. I'm your host today, Ursula Rudenberg, and I'm here with my co-host,
Deborah Bunka.
Hi.
Today we'll visit with the Ames Community Arts Council and find out about the bicycle rack competition.
Today we'll also visit with the First Christian Church in Ames, where they hold their annual community Thanksgiving dinner. Everyone is welcome.
And then we'll visit with Jonathan Buffalo of the Meskwaki Nation. Belinda Merritt is the new coordinator for the Ames Community Arts Council, and she stopped by to explain what the bicycle rack competition is. This is Ursula Rudenberg with KHOI. I'm here with Belinda Merritt, who is the cultural coordinator for the Ames Community Arts Council. I'm also here with Corey Mellis, who is the public works operations manager for the City of Ames. These folks are here to talk about the bicycle rack design competition to install bike racks on downtown Ames. And what is the Ames Community Arts Council?
Ames Community Arts Council is an organization that helps to promote the arts in Ames and the surrounding areas. We have members from different areas of the population in Ames. We have business members, we have artists, we have students, all different walks of life, really. And we're all just in this together to promote the arts and help the public realize what is available in Ames as far as the arts and different activities, classes, concerts, that sort of thing.
Belinda and Corey, could you tell us a little bit how this project got started, the bicycle rack design competition? Who thought of this idea? Why did this come into being?
Our president at Ames Community Arts Council, actually this year she's a co-president, Barbara Walton. She is an artist and an art professor at ISU, and she has her studio on Main Street. She told me that when she first started working in her studio, she would ride her bike and she would have to chain her bike to a lamppost every day. And she also was working with another artist who had a studio on Main Street. He was a sculptor. And just putting two and two together, it sounds like she came up with the idea of not only a need for bicycle racks in downtown Ames, but also because she was doing some work with a sculptor, she thought of possibly asking artists to do creative designs for these racks that would reflect the spirit of Ames.
So how did the city get involved with this?
Well, Corey, would you care to address that?
Yes, I was asked to work with the Ames Community Art Council, I think about a year ago, when this was brought forward to the city. So we maintain all the bike racks currently downtown. So I was asked to work with Ames Community Art Council, and so I helped them find a location so we can make sure the project is viable.
Why did the city feel that this was necessary?
People who park their bicycles on Main Street are likely to chain their bicycles to parking meters, lamp posts, any available stationary object. In fact, I've seen some bicycles sitting in the middle of the sidewalk with the wheels chained. So it's really a hazard to pedestrians to have these bicycles parked in this manner. The existing racks are few and far between, and I have been told that they do seem to have some damage also. And it's really inconvenient for people to find these racks and use them. We're hoping that, you know, with a more plentiful supply of racks, that maybe we can get some of these bicycles off the sidewalks and away from the parking meters and the light poles.
Belinda, you're hoping that area artists will provide beautiful designs, somewhat sculptural, of the bicycle racks?
Yes, we're hoping that the designs will somehow reflect the spirit of Ames. We are trying to emphasize the balance between art and function. The bicycle racks must be designed to withstand the outdoor elements as well as heavy recreational use. We're asking for designs in three different size groups, large, medium, and small. The large rack must accommodate between 6 and 8 bicycles, the medium rack between 3 and 5, and the small rack 2 bikes. And they must be user-friendly for a wide range of cyclists, including children. We are asking for creative designs, but the design must also consider safety. So we don't allow any sharp edges or openings that would be dangerous. It must comply with accessibility standards of the ADA. That means there's no overhangs or protrusions that could be difficult for visually impaired pedestrians to navigate.
And what will the bicycle racks be made out of?
They will be made of durable materials for permanent exposure to the elements.
So they can be wood or metal?
As long as they can withstand a 10-year life expectancy, and that's with the exclusion of the paint. The paint can be redone during that time.
And where will these racks be located?
Well, locations for the racks will be large racks at City Hall and Tom Evans Park, medium racks both at Main and Kellogg and Main and Douglas, and the two small racks will be located between Douglas and Burnett on Main Street.
And how soon will these racks be installed?
We hope to have those racks installed by the end of May of 2013.
That's exciting. Next May.
Yes.
And who will be making the selection?
We will have a committee composed of representatives from Ames Community Arts Council, Main Street Cultural District, the City of Ames, as well as probably some local artists and designers, possibly some people who do welding. There will be a variety of different people on the committee.
And is the competition already in progress?
Yes, it is. But there is still time to enter if you're interested in doing so. The deadline is December 31st of this year.
So you're encouraging anybody to send in an application, and if they want to do so, they should go to amesart.org to see the specific sites and where the racks will be and for the application?
Right. And the applications are due on December 31st of this year. Decisions will be made by February 1st of 2013, and the artists will be notified then.
So the rack does not have to be done by December 31st, just the application explaining to the Arts Council what you would build if you were approved.
Yes, and drawings of different views of the racks, that sort of thing. All of the information for an application should be on the website.
So if I'm interested in applying for this and
right.
proposing a design, I should go to amesart.org for the application.
Right.
And then have the design turned in by December 31st. And when will I be notified that the design has been accepted or rejected?
We will be notifying the artists on or around February 1st of 2013.
So if you go to your website, you can see examples of other bicycle racks?
Yes, you can. And it's very entertaining to see what other communities have come up with.
Great. Well, so soon we'll have some of those too.
We're hoping to have those installed by the end of May in 2013.
Okay. Thank you.
KHOI reporter Cynthia McClure had a chance to sit down with Kathy Krebs of First Christian Church in Ames. They talked about the community Thanksgiving dinner and what inspires Kathy to have volunteered for 16 years.
Yeah, something that's really near and dear to our hearts, is just seeing the folks from the community get together not only on the side of partaking in the meal, but also in the side of putting this on, because it really is a community effort. We will have about 110 volunteers that will also help put this on. So it's not just us alone that does it. It really takes the community.
So these are the people from making the turkeys to baking the pies to serving the meals and getting everything together.
Yes, setting the tables, greeting people. Yes. This year we had some folks contact us in September to make sure their name got on the list to continue to volunteer. And what's really neat about that too is we see families coming now, and the parents are bringing their children in because the children can help serve the bread baskets, they can roll silverware, they can help clear the plates. So it's really bringing those young people into our community of volunteering as well.
How many people do you serve on this Thanksgiving?
Last year we served 499 meals in-house. We had almost 100 meals that we had for delivery and takeout. We also go out and we'll pick people up, so we'll give them a ride to the church if they don't have a means of transportation. Or if they're in their home and they're not able to get out, we'll actually deliver those meals to them in the Ames area.
Yeah, that's a lot of meals.
Yes, it is.
Are you just serving the Ames community, or do you drive these meals out to people in the outlying communities? How does this work?
We're only able to serve in the Ames community for our deliveries. But we do have some folks that come from out of town to the meals. And if they have someone that can come pick those up, we'll be glad to fix those meals for them.
So what got you involved in it, Kathy?
You know, just that passion that I have of seeing people together, seeing people happy, helping folks. We know with the economic times that it's a little bit harder for some folks. And this is a way that we know on one day they can come together and they will have a meal. And I think just over the years it has expanded itself. We do partner with Food at First for this meal because they don't provide on Thanksgiving Day the meal. So we have a lot of folks that they will refer over to us as well for the meal. It truly is a community-wide event that's sponsored and put on by the community. We have folks from the other downtown churches that come over and volunteer. And we also are able to borrow some of their pots and pans.
Oh, yeah.
As they're cooking 175 pounds of potatoes. And then we've added this 160 pounds of sweet potatoes and 60 pounds of squash. You need a few extra big kettles to do all of those in.
So you put on the whole fixings. This is a very traditional meal that you're making.
Yes, it is. We'll have 325 pounds of turkey. We'll have green bean casserole. We'll have the three potatoes I mentioned along with gravy. We'll have some sweet potato casseroles. We'll have corn, peas and pearl onions, a variety of salads. We'll have breads, and then we'll have dessert. We'll have pies, too.
So how many pies would you have this year? I mean, are you guesstimating?
Probably around 60 to 70 pies.
Wow.
And we do have a few other. We will also, I want to mention for our vegetarian friends out there, that we will have the tofu turkey that we'll be serving as well.
How do you get a tofu turkey? Where do you get those?
Wheatfields actually prepares those for us, donates, and then we cook them at the church.
So do you get a lot of your food items donated to you for this event?
A lot of them, with the exception of the turkey. And then we do purchase, but a lot of folks in the community also do monetary donations. And so then we're able to go out and purchase that 325 pounds of turkey that we will actually cook at the church. We'll debone that at the church and have that ready for serving. So
when they first started serving this meal, do you know how many people they had?
Well, the history of the very beginning is the minister at First Christian Church was single at the time. He had other commitments that were around Thanksgiving, so he was not able to travel outside of Ames. He was going to have a TV dinner. And there were a couple women in the church that got wind of that, and they said, no way, not going to happen. You know, we're going to come to the church, and you're going to come over, and we'll have a traditional Thanksgiving dinner. And so from that very first dinner 25 years ago, it has just grown and grown and grown and grown to include anyone in the community.
So what a tradition. Do you anticipate it growing?
We don't know for sure if it will grow or not. We see students that are more and more not able to go home for whatever reason, whether it can also be just a cost factor for them, you know, that the gas is higher and or the bus ticket is higher, and so they're going to stay in Ames. So we've had more students come and additional families with the economic times. You know, we wish we could just do this and say, come one, come all, just because we want you to come and not have to worry about whether you need it or not.
So what do you have to be thankful for, you know, during this holiday season?
I think I simply have so much to be thankful for that I can be with other people and I can help put that smile on their face and hopefully warm their heart as well as their stomach during this Thanksgiving season.
So you talked about the people that get food delivered to them so they can't be in this, you know, kind of warming environment. So how does that happen?
Well, we actually have folks that volunteer to drive. So we prepare a hot dish pack for them, which has all of the hot food in it. We prepare a cold dish pack with their salad in it. And then, of course, we make sure that they have the dessert. They have some of that homemade pie. One of the pizza places, which is Domino's here in town, offers their service through letting us use their delivery bags. And so that keeps the hot food hot at a safe temperature to eat and the cold food cold at that safe temperature to eat as well.
Is there a tradition in Ames that cooking a meal, do you think, is a little too overwhelming for them? You know, so they, is that why they call upon the church?
I think it can be maybe some of that. Maybe one year I know that we had a family that had just had a newborn baby 3 days before, and the husband's parents and two brothers and their wives and family were coming. The newborn's mom called, and she was in tears. And she said, somebody told me I might be able to have meals delivered because I don't know how I'm going to cook. I just had a baby 3 days ago. And so, you know, those tears, I just wanted to cry right along with her. So we sent the family out meals so they could have that traditional Thanksgiving. And then those new grandparents could see that new baby, and the new mom didn't have to worry and stress over, how am I going to feed my in-laws that are coming? We actually sent a whole pie to them to help with that. So that was just, you know, that's another example of that heartwarming passion, because that was changing someone's life, even if it was just for that day. It relieved that stress for that new mom.
So if people want to get involved, how can they contact you or contact the church to find out about this?
They can stop by the church. We're located at 611 Clark, or they can call the church at 232-5766.
Do you have a website for the church?
There is a website for the church, and it is just First Christian Church Ames. I should have that right in front of me so that I can do that exact, but I apologize. But if you just Google First Christian Church Ames, it'll take you right to it, and it will give the information as well.
Is there anything that else you would like to add regarding this, you know, this event?
Just know that anyone in the community is welcome to come, and the more we have, the larger the family.
So this has like become an extended family for you.
Yes, it has. In fact, one of the other things I might mention, we do have a family that brothers and sisters come from out of state. And so we set up an 8-foot table for that family every year. We'll put a little reserve sign on it, and they have their Thanksgiving dinner.
This is really wonderful. I'm happy that you shared this story with me.
And thanks for letting me share it. That means a lot to me as well.
Okay. Thank you for your time.
Part of the Thanksgiving tradition. Debbie and I decided to go to the Meskwaki settlement a few miles away from Tama, Iowa, to find out more about another part of the Thanksgiving tradition, relations with the indigenous people in America. Jonathan Buffalo, who is the historic preservation director and who has recently directed the development of a new museum built by the Historic Preservation Department, sat down with us and generously gave us a few hours to tell us the story of the indigenous people who share Iowa with us. Mr. Buffalo met us at the new museum.
Meskwaki is our own name. That's our creator-given name. And he said, I created you out of red earth, so I'll call you red earth people. Meshk is the root word. It either means blood or red. Meshk is dirt or earth. It's the dirt. When you add that K-I at the end, you humanize it. You turn it into a human. Red earth people is the general translation, and it's how we were created. And as long as we remember that we're Meskwakis, human, but we're a different human than other people. We're created out of red earth. We don't claim to be descendants of Adam and Eve, because those are other humans. You got to remember, us Meskwakis are ancient people in this continent. We're very old. You may not see a mastodon walking down the road, but we existed when that thing existed. We used to hunt those. So we're very old, and we remember a lot. So we're very old people. We've met a lot of people. First, we met the French, which we fought a war, but we kind of respect as enemies. Even though the French don't remember us, we remember the Spanish, the Mexicans, the English, and now the Americans, which haven't left yet. You know, in Iowa, we're very new archaeologically. We're on top of the ground. When archaeologists are looking for Indians, they usually scrape us up because we're so new in Iowa archaeologically. As you go east, we go deeper into the ground. In Wisconsin, we're a little bit deeper. Michigan, we're a little bit deeper. Ohio, New York, Connecticut, you know, all the way to the East Coast, we get deeper into the ground and we get older.
Can you describe this area, Iowa?
Iowa was marsh and prairie with woods along the riverbank.
Mm-hmm.
Each creek, deep woods, but in between were little patches of prairie, but mostly swamp. Ames was a swamp. Iowa was sort of this barren area because it's too marshy. Nobody wanted to live in this marsh. But after we got kicked out of Wisconsin, when we came into Iowa, it was semi-abandoned by the Sioux, even though they claimed it.
What was here then?
The Iowa tribe.
Mm-hmm.
Siouan tribes were in this area. Prehistorically, it's Iowa, Santee Sioux, also Missouri, Siouan tribes. Because the Algonquins, which we belong to, are more from the east. But we all migrated west because of the Iroquois. We migrated west through Connecticut, New York, Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, and finally came into Iowa. And when we came into Iowa, by 1735, we crossed the Mississippi because we just had fought a war with the French. And we come into Iowa and we meet Siouan people. We kind of pushed them off, except for the Iowa, which we became allied with the Iowa tribe. But the rest of the Sioux tribes, we kind of chased off. We took half of Missouri, north of the Missouri River, most of Iowa. But we said, this is what we want. This is it. And there's a lot of definitions of what Iowa means. Some think it's from the Iowa tribe, but we say Iowa means when we came to Iowa, we said, Ayuhe, over here. Ayuhe, over here. This is it. So our name Iowa means over here. This is it. This is our dream. You know,
it's like be here now.
You know, you're like be here now.
Yeah.
This is it. You know, that's what it means. You know. Other tribes might have been in and out of our boundary areas. You know, it fluctuated, but the center is Davenport, Rock Island. That was our center of power, and we would migrate west into Iowa for hunting.
What was in the Davenport area at the time when this was the center of the culture?
We lived in the summer village, a huge village. Then in the wintertime, we would break apart into winter camps.
So when you would hunt, you lived, you brought your houses with you, or how did you?
They're weak, yeah. They're dome-shaped.
What were they made of?
Willows. You make a dome, a shell, and you covered it with cattail mats.
Wow.
Very comfortable. In the summer village, before we started having regular houses, we lived in summer houses, which are bigger. They're gable-shaped houses, square. That household went to a winter camp, and they divided up into individual weekend. Like maybe grandparents had one weekend. A couple yards away was a grown son, maybe a couple grown sons and their families, and anybody that belonged to that household. Maybe three or four weekends in an area, and it's easier to warm a weekend up in the wintertime than a big summer house.
And was this built there, or was this something you moved?
No, you can build a week. The shell, you can build it in an hour.
How did you subsist?
Without modern technology, thermostat, gasoline, it's a very hard place to live. You can die in this bioregion. You can freeze to death. You can starve. It's a very harsh environment. It doesn't look harsh, but it's very harsh without modern stuff. If you don't prepare, for winter, winter can kill you. So that's the mentality that we've always had, is we prepare. So we prepared enough food to last us mid-summer. By that time, there's new plants growing. So we just went and gathered those plants, and we did a little hunting.
You were not Plains Indians.
We're woodland Indians. You know, we were at the edge of the plains, and we hunted in the plains, but we never transferred. We had a horse culture, but we just never became Plains Indian type.
What's the difference?
1,000 years ago, there was no such culture of Plains Indians because the plains was too vast and too big to be walking around. So people hugged the wood and only walked into the plains to hunt. It's only after the horse when you get that Plains Indian type. And that's only a couple hundred years old. With us, we got the horse, but we never changed our lifestyle. So we never became a plains culture. Government wanted to break our hold on the Mississippi because by then they wanted to go to California, and they fought a war with the Sacandon Squaw, the Blackhawk War. So they sort of tried to beat us into submission, and that way the movement could continue on west, because that was the idea, to move west. So when white people came in, the first group came in after the Blackhawk War in the 1830s and the 40s. Were native-born Americans, people from Indiana, Ohio, Pennsylvania, the Daniel Boone, Davy Crockett type. They come in, and we knew Americans, you know. The word is Kichimukuman. It means lawn knife, because when the Americans came, it was always the army that came first, and the officers had swords, so we called the whole group lawn knife. So when we say Mukuman, up in town, we say Mukuman. People think we're calling them white people. We're not calling them white people. We're calling them lawn knives. So we met those people, and we knew who they were. And some people found it so harsh, they moved on to California. After the Black Hawk War, we moved inward. Then we started having our summer villages in Iowa, like in Iowa City, Ottumwa, in those areas. By 1845, we signed a treaty to remove us to Kansas, which is out of our bioregion. By the 1850s, we come back. And in the meantime, another group came in. By the 1850s, we come back. another group came in, foreign-born Americans, mostly Northern Europe, mostly from Germany, Dutch, Norwegians, and they filled up, you know, you can tell by the towns in Iowa what the local ethnic group is, you know. Those began to fill up because it reminded them of home. They could live in it. They knew how to survive in it. And we met those people, non-English speaking people, and their first thought when they saw us coming up the road wasn't to shoot at us, but to talk to us. Curiosity. And we were curious of them too. And we never had any problems because there was a certain amount of respect between the two. The first group of people that came, they just wanted us out. When they said move, get out of the way, we did. We moved on to Kansas. But this other group, the second group, we taught them how to live in Iowa. We knew what, at the very beginning, you know, when they're making their houses, before they started developing, we knew what, we taught them how to eat mushrooms. We knew what plants were poisonous, you know, things like that. We gave them food. We delivered their babies, because at that time there was no doctors. Me and my wife run the exhibit tent during powwow, and every year we sit there and for 4 days and we answer questions. We believe that there's no silly question. But one thing that comes up every year is people that come with their Indian stories. We've heard so many stories of Indian women, Meskwaki women, saving their great-great-grandmothers at childbirth. Mm-hmm. If there was a difficult birth, they always knew there was a local Indian camp, so they went and got the Indian women, and those are the ones that delivered the babies. We hear dozens of stories like that. Mm-hmm. We knew what medicine to take for birth or any sickness, so we hear a lot of stories like that. And it's sort of like people come and thank us. Because without us, their great-great-grandmother wouldn't have been born, so they wouldn't exist. So they kind of thank us. That's the relationship.
Did people relate to each other more beyond that socially, or did they just help each other?
I think they just helped each other.
But they stayed separate.
They kind of stayed separate, but mm-hmm. It was a friendship because these people realized we were religious, but religious in our own way. But they recognized our values. And we recognized them as being religious. So there was a common thing. We respected each other's values. One lady just recently came and donated a beaded piece, which in her family history is her grandmother was cooking lunch for her menfolk that were working on that field. Then she said an Indian canoed up, reached his canoe, walked up, and she said he motioned he wanted something to eat. She gave him a sandwich of what she was cooking. And afterwards, he gave her this beaded pincushion as a gift. And he got on his canoe and he went on his way.
Very nice.
We hear lots of stories like that, though.
Very nice.
You know, and they're all good encounters. You know, there's never a bad encounter. We haven't heard my Indians came and massacred my family. We never hear that. It's always settlers finding Indians sprawled out next to their fireplace, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, we didn't even hear them come in, you know. Or exchanges, you know, maybe it was deer meat, you know, things like that.
Were there battles fought in this area? Any significant battles, or was this relatively peaceful?
The only Indian incident is the Spirit Lake Massacre in northern Iowa, but that's with the Sioux, you know, so, but not with us, you know.
Mayu, mayu, abine, weyo, weya, weya, we, heya, weya, ho, heyo, weya, weya, ho, heyo, weya, weya, we.
We're very different in Iowa. We're a very different tribe mentally because we were treated as equals. So in Iowa, as a tribe, we're somewhat used to being treated as equals. And we think like that. You know, we haven't been beaten up like most tribes, beaten into submission, because we lived our traditional way of life clear up to World War II. And that's when we quit living in a summer, winter thing, you know.
So that went all the way to World War II?
Mm-hmm. We roamed Iowa.
Until World War II?
Mm-hmm. Because, like I said, we developed a friendship with that second group of people. We had a relationship with the original landowner.
So how did that work?
So when we would go to camp, go to their farm, we asked, they knew us.
And you would camp on their farm?
We would camp on their farm. We would.
That's awesome.
We would
awesome.
Probably take care of their rodent, what they considered rodent population, beavers, muskrats.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we would trap them out. So we had that relationship from 1857 to World War II. We basically had the freedom of movement. We could, each family on the settlement has a traditional hunting area. My family's area was Marengo. Some went to Story County, went towards Ames. Some went towards Des Moines. Some went to Black Hawk County. You know, we all have our areas that we knew the people. But by World War II, most of the men went to war. Most of the women went to go work in the factories. After the war, nobody wants to go. They've learned a trade. So why would you go spend the winter collecting hides to sell where you could just go work? So that kind of ended that. And plus two, by World War II, the original owners had died. Maybe we didn't have a relationship with the children. But by 1945, we sure didn't have a relationship with the grandkids. It's like Iowa forgot about us. The people forgot about us. It's like when we look at our neighbors, our Iowa citizens, it's like having a friend that has Alzheimer's. They don't remember you, but we remember them.
Mm.
It's like trying to talk to somebody that's... Because we still remember. We remember the racial groups that existed in each town, and they knew us. But like I said, my wife and I run the exhibit tent there in Powwow. We're the ones that hear those stories, those little family histories of... My grandpa remembers when there used to be Indians camped at the creek, kind of stories, you know. And we keep telling people, write them down, write your little family history, and save it.
Mm.
Because it's not only our history, it's Iowa's history. Iowa is a very unique state that hasn't given itself credit to how it treats its native resident population.
Can you explain that?
Well, at the same time, Iowa was allowing a tribe of Indians to buy land. California was exterminating their Indians. And I mean exterminated. They went out to kill off their Indian population. We were buying land in the 1850s. While Indians in California are being hunted down and killed like that. And there's a whole bunch of things that are different. Like I was just reading about the 1924 Citizen Act that made us U.S. citizens. And it's always assumed that we had the voting rights right after the law. We could vote. But I've been reading a lot of states, right after the law was passed, a lot of states passed their own state laws denying Indians the vote. In Iowa, we started voting that November of 1924. Everybody assumed that we had the right to vote, and we never had any trouble voting this past election. We voted. But in some states, it wasn't until the 1950s that people started, in those resident tribes, started voting, like in Arizona, New Mexico, Wyoming, you know, even Maine. They started letting their Indians vote in 1950s, some as 1970. So,
did they have boarding schools here? Was that imposed on people in the Meskwaki?
They tried, but it never succeeded because we're a little, like I said, we're a little bit different. We have a little bit different experience. We did. There was one boarding school, but it closed in 1918. 1911.
So it was never imposed here.
No.
It was never required.
We went to federal court and challenged it, and the court determined that the state didn't have control of our children or the federal government.
And when was that?
Oh, we went to court in 1899.
This fact that you were able to buy land, can you tell that story?
We got removed to Kansas, to a reservation in Kansas, 1845. We left that September. But when we left the agency, which was at Des Moines, the tribe split apart. Some doubled back, went back to Story County, went back to Cedar County, Tama County. And by 1846, only one-fifth of the tribe was in Kansas. The rest were scattered all over Iowa, you know, because it was unsettled still. So, from 1846 to 1857, there was always Meskwakis in Iowa. So in 1856, Iowa passed a law allowing for our continued existence in Iowa, continued residence in Iowa. And then the next year, we went to go see the governor, Governor Grimes, about buying land. He said, I may be the governor, but I can't force any of my citizens to sell you land. I'm not that powerful, he said. But if you find that one person that will sell you land, I'll take the land in trust for you. But you got to go out and find that person. The tribe divided into three groups, and some went towards Iowa City, Marengo area. Some went to the up the Cedar River, Cedar Rapids, Waterloo, and some were roaming around here, trying to find that piece of land that would fit us. And it had to be sort of out of the way, sort of like out of sight, out of mind. Nobody would mind us if we were sort of out of the way. If we were out in the open, people, we would remind people all the time we were Indian. So we wanted a certain spot that would fit us. So they were canoeing down the Iowa River, and they saw this spot, and they said, that's what we want. And it happened to be in Tama County. So they went to the owner, David Butler, and they, who spoke Meskwaki. Like, those older settlers learned how to speak Meskwaki, and we learned how to speak German. So they made a deal with that David Isaac Butler, and we purchased 80 acres.
And where did the money come from to buy the land?
Well, part annuities and part selling horses. $1,000. We paid $1,000 for the first 80 acres.
Was there a reaction against the land being bought, or did it go smoothly when it happened?
As far as I know, it went smoothly.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody protested.
And then you must have bought more land with time, because it got bigger.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
From 1857 to 1990s, there's the old settlement. 3,300 acres. For 100 years, it was that settlement shape, you know. And since with the casino, we doubled our land, we've doubled in size because we own 7,000 acres now here.
And how long has the museum been here?
I'm the Historic Preservation Department. Mm-hmm. I usually been in office, but my office started collecting artifacts through repatriation, purchase, donation, and I started collecting artifacts, the department did. So 2 years ago, this building became vacant, and I asked for the building. We saw we could build a museum in the main hall. So we've been here since June of last year, and we opened up officially in June of 2011, and we've been here 1 full year. We celebrated our first year. But our museum is the only place where you can hear and see the full story of us. We tell our own story. Because most of these museums, when they tell anything about our objects, which is rare, is they talk about the collector. It becomes a collector's history. Mm. And they just happen to have our artifacts. But we're the only ones that truly tell our history. As a tribe, we're very different. Like I said, you know, we'll always be Meskwakis first. But we're also proud to be Iowans. You
know? And that is because of?
Because we live in Iowa. We think this is the great state, the greatest state in the Union.
Really?
You know? And plus, we're also proud to be Americans.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. Today we have been speaking with Belinda Merritt from the Ames Community Arts Council, Kathy Krebs from the First Christian Church, and Jonathan Buffalo, the Historic Development Department of the Meskwaki Nation.
For technical and specific questions concerning the bicycle rack competition, contact Jim Wilcox, co-president and bicycle rack committee chair, at jwskunk@iastate.edu. That's jwskunk@iastate.edu. General questions can be directed to Belinda Merritt at coordinator@amesart.org. That's coordinator@amesart.org. Or you can call 515-233-6110. To contact Kathy at First Christian Church, call 515-232-5766. Or visit their website at www.fccames.org. That's fccames.org. For information about the Meskwaki settlement, visit www.meskwaki.org. That's MESKWAKI.org.
Music we've listened to today has included Blue Dream and Eyes in the Sky from the CD Meskwaki Nation, Rockin' the Bells, and The Smallest One from the CD From the Lodges of the Meskwaki Nation.
Also, the song The Very Thought of You, lyrics and music by Ray Noble, performed by Sandra Briones.
And our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley.
Reporters for this edition are Cynthia McClure, Deborah Bunka, Ursula Rudenberg, and our producer has been Rick Morrison. Reporters for this edition included Cynthia McClure, Deborah Bunka, Ursula Rudenberg. Our engineer was Rick Morrison. To close today's edition, we have recorded people on the street talking about what they're thankful for. Enjoy and have a happy Thanksgiving.
My name's Mitch.
And you're grateful for?
I'm grateful for excellent music.
Does Ames have a lot of that?
There's a great local music scene around here. DG's Tap House has a lot of great bands. Everywhere around here has a lot of great bands.
name is Melissa Reese, and I'm thankful for my daughter.
And your name is?
Todd Morrison.
And you're grateful for?
My family.
My name is Santiago, and I'm grateful for being here doing my internship.
At ISU?
Yeah, at ISU.
And what are you doing an internship
at? Agronomy.
My name is Jesus, and I want to say thanks because I get my master's this year. So.
Your master's in what subject?
In animal science, at ISU as well.
My name is Casey Carter, and I am super grateful for all my awesome friends and family and everybody who is awesome.
My name's Jillian.
And what are you grateful for, Jillian?
I'm grateful for Farrell's Extreme Body Shaping. It's changed my life.
My name is Rita Garten, and I am thankful for the opportunity to play dress up every day and have an awesome job that I love.
My name is Aaron, and I'm thankful for my family.
My name is Sam Barnes, and I'm thankful that I have a lot of cool female friends to hang out with.
I'm Dawn Bracken, and I'm thankful for all my friends in Ames that I get to visit this weekend.
My name's James. I am thankful for my life in general.
It's that good?
Yeah, it really is.
That's great.
I'm Craig, and I'm thankful for freedom and to live in the United States of America, regardless of who's running the show.
I'm Danelle, and I'm thankful for my kids and the rest of my family, friends.
Hi, my name is Carl Hegstrand, and I'm so thankful for my mom. She means the world to me, and I love her so much. Thanks, Mom.
I'm Jessica Testa, and I'm thankful for my family and my kids.
I'm Stephanie Jewell, and I'm thankful for my kids and my mom.
I guess I'm grateful for my mom and my dad, and I guess my daughter, too. So.
I'm Larry. I own the Grove Cafe on Main Street. I'm thankful for my wonderful wife and all my great employees and customers.
I'm Christy, and I work at the Grove Cafe, and I am thankful for my sister who moved here from California, straightening her life out, and I am thankful for my wonderful employer that I have a job, and I am thankful for all of the customers that come into the Grove Cafe because they are really, truly what makes this job fun. Thanks.
I'm thankful for my family, and I'm thankful for a place I get to go to work every day that I love working.
My name is Josh Miller, and I am thankful for my family.
First name is John, and I'd say working with Manette, good thing to be thankful for this year.
Dios, porque estoy saludable y tengo mi familia unida este año.
Well, my name's Ben, and I'm grateful for brown-eyed women and red grenadine.
I'm Stephanie, and I'm thankful that my family is all healthy.
My name is Cristobal Matibag, and I am thankful for the transience of all things.
My name is Josh Hubble, and I am thankful for my family this year.
My name is Cynthia McClure, and I am thankful for my lovely husband who got back last year from Iraq, and he's home this year for Thanksgiving, and thankful for my daughter from being home from the military, and you know, I may have a full house this year, and the first in quite a few years, so I'm thankful for that.